we are joined by one of the best undrafted players in NBA history. He was a top football recruit in high school before getting drafted into baseball and eventually going to Nebraska to play basketball, where he added a Hall of Fame career as a Husker. He had a solid 9-year NBA career with the Mavs, Knicks, Celts, Pacers, Bucks, and Vancouver Grizzlies. Rest in peace. but without further ado, the co-founder of ePlay Analytics, Eric Strickland. How are you doing today?
What's going on? What's going on, my great gentleman? It's a beautiful morning. I'm in Florida. You know, it rained all day yesterday, so for me to be able to sit out back on my patio, have me a good stogie, and get the day off, watch some college football, and prepare for my radio show next Tuesday and get some homework done.
Nice.
So it's a pleasure to be here with you guys today.
Yeah, we appreciate you joining us for sure. But we kind of want to get into like where you got started. Obviously, you know, you were a big time athlete, 3-sport athlete, you know, practically a professional all three at one point. How'd you get kind of that athleticism going at a young age? I know you're born in Alabama, you moved to Nebraska. What was kind of your first love? Was it football? Was it basketball? And where'd you first pick it up?
Yeah, actually football was my first love. It was probably the one that I was best at. If you ask most people that know me or have watched me or had a chance to observe throughout my early steps in my career, even going back to when I played, Pee Wee League football, had the opportunity to play against, you know, some wonderful professionals and guys like, for example, you may remember a guy by the name of Napoleon Kaufman, who played with the Raiders, played up in Washington some years. We got to play Pee Wee football together, but my first exposure to that at a very young age, while I was in California, I would dominate flag football leagues. I was a very big kid. So I was a big and mature kid. So playing in those sports, got to California, got my first taste of tackle football. My team absolutely dominated, to the fact that in all actuality, it was only because I shouldn't have belonged in that league. It was like a kid, a bully taking kid from a baby. Like it really was that bad. I mean, we literally dominated the league 10-0. We'd win by 40, 50, 60 points every game. And I actually jumped a league. And this is what you'll see as a pattern when we get more into discussion is I played in what they called, they had the leagues were Bantam, Junior One, Junior Two, Senior. So I literally jumped Junior One the next year and played in the Junior Two league. So, and had a very good, year as a running back and linebacker. So I got that from my dad. My dad was very athletically gifted. He kept me engrossed in sports. I always had balls in my hand, but the divorce of my parents at an early age led me to have to be very creative, because that was at the times where kids these days, they don't go outside like we, back in my day when we used to. I mean, we'd be outside all day. It'd be, playing sports like baseball was good, easy for me, because we would play stickball. So you're trying to hit a rock, or you're trying to hit a tennis ball with a stick, you can become very proficient. You just add a little more girth and now you have a baseball. So those things, helped on that aspect. We would play what they call, I have to be careful, and I'm not, talking in any negation or any bad way. I have to preface this. This day, you got to preface this with regards to the LGBTQRSTVUV. I'm not coming against them in any way. I'm saying, this is the name we used to call it back in the 80s, early 80s. So it's called, and we called it Smear the Queer. We used to play Smear the Queer, and you would throw the ball up, and whoever caught it, you have to evade 6, 8, 10 people trying to murder you, and it was, you trying to shake and bake and speed and run and tackle, and we used to hit. So all of those things kind of helped me with regards to that. And basketball, sometimes you may not have a hoop, but we would be creative, and I would just create, like, in my mind, you know, different things on the garage, and that would be the basket, and I have to hit it. And you know, so all of these things in the aspect of creativity helped me to be able to develop my skills at an earlier age. And I would have to say it started with the divorce of my parents, because it made me, being by myself with my dad, I would go for hours. I would get on my bike and ride and get my food. And, you know, so I had to be mature in that. And I'd go to the little elementary park and I'd play with no nets. And I would act like I was the Lakers versus the Celtics. And I would be creatively working on different things that I'd seen. And so, you know, in a nutshell, that's kind of created Eric Strick.
Nice. And so you said you're in California. You mentioned your dad was a military. Was that a base that you were on out there? Or?
Yeah, a base out there. It's just north of Santa Barbara, about 40 miles, a place called Lompoc, California. There was Vandenberg Air Force Base that was hovered right in there. My dad was in missiles. So, you know, anywhere that there was missile silos, that's why I was in Great Falls, Montana, because that's where the missile silos were that he had to be in. But there was the, you know, they launched a lot of the missiles off the West Coast as well. So, yeah, that's kind of where we had to be.
That's cool.
Yeah, definitely. And then what, when did that transition happen as you got, you know, moved on towards Nebraska? Was that after Great Falls?
No. So after Great Falls, I think I was probably 6 to 8, mm-hmm. maybe mid part of 9, moved to California.
Gotcha.
And so I was in California like my 5th, 6th, and part of my 7th grade year. And then I moved and literally missed football my 7th grade year, got there in the winter. And I think I even missed basketball. I either missed it or just hit it. And so soon as I arrived, you know, there was a big buzz. So I got to do track and kind of started breaking records in track. Like high jump records, long jump records, and shot put records and stuff like that. And so then, you know, some of the high school started kind of watching me. So I got there my middle junior year, seventh grade year. By the 8th grade year, I played a full season of football. And we used to beat the 9th grade team. Like, that's how good our football team was. We, you know, we had some studs, and we would beat our 9th grade team. We, you know, we would scrimmage them and kill them.
Ooh.
And, so we actually won the city. And then the high school coach came down and checked me out, and he wanted to bring me in to play as a freshman. So at this time, what you had was junior high. So your junior high was 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Right?
So you're at one facility, and then your high school was 10, 11, 12. So they came down, they said they wanted to bring me up. So they every year, every practice and whatnot, they would bus me to the high school so that I could go to practice after school. And so I did that and had a great, you know, freshman year up through there and junior high. Just, it was a great experience. I got to play and have some wonderful times with some great guys until I got to high school. But that's kind of how it worked out, you know, me getting to Nebraska. And I didn't want to go. Let me say that. I'll preface that. My dad said, we're going to Nebraska. And I'm like, I don't want to go. I want to play for Cabrillo, the Conquistadors, black and gold. My dad was an Alpha. So I was like, yeah, I'm playing for black and gold. And I must say, hindsight 2020, I'm glad, you know, we were able to get to Nebraska. The exposure I was able to get out of there, it was phenomenal.
Yeah, you ended up a Nebraska legend. You didn't really get there till high school, but you still managed to take over the state. You know, Hall of Famer for the Huskers. That's a hell of an 8-year run, really, going from like 9th year, ninth grade through senior year of college. Like, that's a hell of a takeover for sure. So you transitioned to, you were a wide receiver in high school though, right? Not running back.
Right. Yeah, I was a wide receiver. That was what they wanted for me. It was pretty much like, again, that's just like you said, just being an athlete. I wasn't a speedster, maybe 4.6 guy, you know what I mean? I maybe could dip into a 4.5, high 4.5. That wasn't a speed. I just ran great routes. I was physical. And if it was in my area, it was caught. One hand, two hand, no hand, you know, in the rib cage, diving. It just, anything was, if you threw it and double cover or not, it was caught. So that's what kind of made me really good. And but, you know, you've got to think about it, that a young kid, I mean, I was being pretty heavily recruited football wise. I could have went to, you know, the likes of back then, the UCLA's and Colorado's, and, you know, they were all perennial powers back then. And of course, Nebraska, but, you know, Nebraska didn't throw. I think, to be honest, guys, I was ahead of my time as far as, now they have these hybrid type guys now, you know, your Kelsey's, your Jimmy Graham's, your, you know what I mean, your Niles Paul's, you know what I mean? They have these hybrid type guys that they call H-backs or whatever, that do a lot of different things, similar to what, what's my guy from Florida, rest in peace. He got, you know, arrested.
Hernandez. Yeah.
So very similar. I would have been very similar to him, but I was just ahead of my time. Wow. In the same likes as basketball. I was not a traditional point. That's why I didn't get drafted. I wasn't a traditional point guard. I was just a player.
Right.
And you see it now, you know, because you see your Draymond Greens and you see your, you know, Gilbert Arenas's, and you see a lot of these types of situations now that weren't, you know, when I was coming through. So that's why I didn't get drafted, but I was able to, you know, show and prove that somebody can do multiple things from this position.
Nice. Yeah, so when did basketball kind of take over for you? Was that freshman year when you started to realize, like, you like basketball more, or was that a little later?
Yeah, I think it was earlier that I realized. I would say, I think it's because of the dreams I had. I would have dreams, and my dreams would be very vivid, and I knew I would be somewhere. I didn't really see the NFL. Baseball was nowhere in the spectrum of what I thought. I knew I could play it. I enjoyed it. It was something fun to do in the off season to keep me busy. It wasn't something like that for me, but, so basketball really kicked off earlier than that for me, because that was what I saw in my dreams. I actually saw myself in dreams playing in the NBA. So I knew I was good at it, and I felt that the other sports I played and did well at helped and culminated in me being a great basketball player, even though it wasn't my best sport, but it helped me. So the physical aspects of football helped me with regards to that. Being a good linebacker, safety, being able to see and see formations and kind of understand who their go-to guys are and read pattern, route patterns, and being able to do that helped me in basketball of understanding play sets and, okay, this is Karl Malone. Okay, they're trying to go here. So it helped me to kind of defensively be able to be very good at what I did. Understanding tendencies, you know, understanding that, okay, Allen Iverson, if he's going left, he's shooting. If he's going right, I'm in trouble. You know what I mean? And understanding these different things about certain players that helped me to be able to be good at what I did. And so that's kind of the explanation of why I loved it so much, is because then I felt baseball gave me the cerebral aspect of it, meaning there were going to be nights where I had, you know, I may have gone 3 for 10 in the first half. And I have to really forget that. I have to be able to wash that away and feel that I can hit the next 5. And it's the same thing in baseball. I mean, 3 for 10 is great in baseball. You know what I mean? You fail. You learn to fail.
Yeah.
And fail well. If you can do that and fail well, and you can be successful. So understanding the cerebral aspects of it, understanding he's a pull hitter. Ball's hitting this gap. This is where it's got to go. So you're thinking multiple plays ahead based on what's happening with the ball. If the ball's hit here, got a second, you got to go boom, cutoff man. But you got to play all these simulations in your head while you're standing there waiting for something to happen and still be able to react. So that's what I believe baseball gave to me with regards to basketball. It helped me with the cerebral aspect to make sure I have success and failure.
Absolutely. No, that's such a great point too. And, you know, learning how to fail and fail well is such great advice, because so many people, it seems like once you struggle, you get into that rut and you can't find a way out, you know? So that's, I love how you're able to combine all three of those sports together and then make it your own, as you've seen, like with tendencies and thinking ahead like that. I mean, shoot, you were way ahead of your time then thinking about that stuff, you know, about Allen Iverson and which way he's going, you know? So that's really interesting, Coach, that you're able to put that all together.
Well, see, I'll really blow your mind in that, because I was at home, you know, my dad, you know, he'd have to, he was an officer in the Air Force. He'd have to, I had to, you know, be able to fend and do myself even at a young age. And that's what being mature was good for me, but it helped me to even mature more. But with that, I was even thinking about collective bargaining agreements. So I was, as a you know, 16, 17, 18-year-old kid, I'm even looking into those things. I'm looking at football. I'm looking at, okay, you get, they get their bonus, their signing bonus up front, okay, boom. And then they get a contract, but, if they don't like me during the season, they can cut me and they don't have to pay me. And I'm giving my body, what is the average years of service? I'm looking at all those things as a young kid, and I'm figuring it out. Although baseball was the best, baseball, when I got there, I understood the minor leagues and how the minor leagues work. If you have a David Justice or you have a Deion Sanders, or you have somebody up at the top, you could be a AAA a long time, even though you're good enough. Even though you're doing good enough. And so I started thinking about that. I'm like, money's great. Money's long. I like the aspect, 182 games, a game every day. Okay, I like that. But basketball. Yeah, I really like that. You know what I mean? Small, good fraternal, you know, aspects of it. It's not a, you know, whole big conglomerate of people, you know, and I love just everything about it. That's kind of how I came to it. I'm sorry, that was a long answer.
No, that's awesome. I mean, we always talk, I mean, Andy and I talk about that all the time when a guy, you know, there's kids coming up that are football recruits that are also pretty good at basketball. We're like, man, once he figures out the money aspect, he's gonna go with basketball, because it's still a problem to this day with the football contracts that we complain about.
So but, Mike, think about this, right? That's what Charlie Ward did.
Yep.
That's exactly what Charlie Ward could play quarterback. I'm with regards to that back then, the way they looked at, you know, quarterbacks similar to him, goes, you know, running type quarterbacks. They didn't look at him the way they look at Lamar Jackson type.
So he
thought about that. He looked at that aspect and knew he would be a first round draft pick. So shoot, why not?
Yeah. Right. No, so that's awesome. What so I read that you didn't really play football your senior year, is that right? And then you hadn't played baseball your whole high school time for the most part until your senior year? Walk us through kind of how that the senior year of kind of taking over and getting drafted and, you know, eventually making that decision to go to the Huskers and stuff.
So, again, I'm looking at all these aspects. I have a slight impingement in my shoulder, which was just a slight AC joint separation, which is my shooting arm, right? My quarterback. His cluster, his sons right now, he's got two sons, one playing Seahawks. He's on their, you know, kind of their ready squad, probably their practice squad. His name is Katie Johnson. And he's got another son at Iowa who's going to be a stud, Keegan Johnson. He's playing at Iowa as a freshman that most people don't do. So Cluster Johnson was my best friend. He was my quarterback. And going into my senior year, he's gone. So I'm weighing the whole scenario and I'm looking at it. Okay, there's a young quarterback. He was on JV. He's probably going to be all right. But they're probably going to play me at quarterback, running back, wide receiver, slot back, linebacker. Said I was probably going to have to play every dang position and get killed. Now, I know I made the right decision because that year they went 0-8. So I thought about being out in the cold Nebraska wind, practicing, and being beat the heck up. What am I going to be like for basketball? That's really how I was thinking because I knew I loved basketball. So I said it was a tough decision, but my coach, he was very disappointed. He was upset, but I had to say, nah, I can't do it. So one of my marketing teachers, his name was Dave Schillinglaw, and he had a conversation. He sat down. He's like, Eric, I realize you're not going to play football, but I want to talk to you about possibly playing baseball. Now, I hadn't played baseball since like my freshman year where I played Legion ball or something like that. And so I said, he says, yeah, man, I really believe that if you play baseball, you'll get drafted. I said, man, please, come on, man, stop. You bugging. You know what I mean? I'm like, whatever, man. He's like, no, for real, Strick, I think if you really play, you'll get drafted. I said, okay, well, I'll play. I mean, I ain't doing nothing. So I decided to play. So then I end up going out. I hit like 483, which was crazy. I was a line drive hitter. So if I hit home runs, they were just going out quick. I mean, so I hit in the gaps and I was, you know, doubles and triples. And you know, I had an above average arm. I played right field. I think I played center in high school. So all of a sudden, scouts started calling. They started coming. There's about 10 of them that came. Yankees is one of them. I think White Sox. I don't even think the Marlins came, but it was a few of them. So, man, maybe the Marlins did come. So I'm out hitting batting practice, doing drills, you know, all of that. Had a great showing. Yankees wanted to take me in the first round. They called and they said, we want to take you in the first round, but we want you to be full time. We want you playing baseball in the winter leagues, summer leagues, full time. And you know, we'll take you in the first round. And I said, well, what is the other option? And then the Marlins came and they said, we'll take you in the middle rounds. We'll let you do both. You come to extended spring, you'll play short season, and then you can go back, do base, and we'll pay for your school. So basically, I am the greatest walk-on in Nebraska basketball history because they didn't have to use a scholarship on me. The Marlins paid for my school.
That's unbelievable. So, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
Basically, I was a non-scholarship walk-on Hall of Famer.
That's amazing. The old stickball skills came back pretty quick senior year. Bad 483 with the big boys. That's
yeah.
Wild.
I mean, it was sick. It was sick. It really was. I was quite amazed. And listen, and I did that not knowing I had astigmatism in my eyes.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I found out we had a, you know, because mostly this is the thing about baseball that people don't tell. And so, you know, the first season I get there, they put you in a hotel. They put you in with four guys. So there's three other guys. So you share a room with a guy and your other roommates, and it's a nice apartment. It's a really nice apartment. You're like, cool. Oh, this is all right. You go every morning at 7 in the morning. You do early drills, you know, base running, whatever the drills are for that morning, hitting drills, field drills, whatever. You're doing all of that. The sun comes up in Florida. And, yeah, in the middle of the summer, and it's hot like fire. So you're drenched, you're sweating, you go back, get hydrated, you know, eat a lunch, and then you play. Usually your game is around noon every day, noon, 1 o'clock,
yeah,
in the high noon sun of Florida. So then you play, boom, you're done, but you have your evening, so it's pretty cool. But what they don't tell you is that second season, they take you to, we were in the New York Penn League, so they take you to New York, they put you in a hotel, you're like, cool, you're in the Holiday Inn, you're like, all right, got a little time, you know, make something happen. If you don't find a place within 3 days, you got to pay $300 a night. And you ain't got, you got minor league money. So you like, $300, let me find you a little place. Roommate, man, let's find a place. So you find a nice little spot with a guy. And you find a terrible, there's not really nothing good you're going to find in 3 days in there, right? So the thing was, we had a night game when I was, I think I was still in Florida. And in the daytime, I'm good. I can see. But at night, I kind of was squinting. And so I'm at bat and I'm squinting. And I think my third base coach, I was hitting from the left side. I could switch, but they wanted me to focus on the left because I didn't play enough to be proficient at it. Mm-hmm. So he's looking at me. He's like, man, can you see? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, why are you squinting? I'm like, oh, I didn't realize I was doing that. So they took me to get my eyes checked, and they found out. That's where I found out I had astigmatism. And then I had contacts. I used the contacts for a while. And then I think after my time, right before I went to the NBA, maybe my last year at Nebraska, I ended up getting LASIK. And when I tell you, the goal lit up like never before. So shooting threes to me, it looked like I was right in the rim. I'm like, dang, I didn't realize I'm shooting all this time, then I really couldn't see the rim in full clarity.
That's so amazing.
That's kind of how that worked out, man. It was a weird thing.
That's wild. Any crazy like high school basketball stories? I know we hit your other sports in high school, but any you know, big games or big matchups that you know, still stick with you today?
So there was a freshman rival that was similar to me. So I'm the number two scorer all time in Nebraska history, and he's number one. And he went to the state tournament every year, and I probably went twice. So he had significantly more games than I had to do it. So in the last game, it took him 50 points. And I'm looking at this team and I'm like, are y'all really going to let this guy just, are you not going to double team him? Are you going to let someone else? I'm watching the game and I'm looking at them and it felt like a conspiracy theory. I'm like, it just looked like they just let him do whatever he wanted to do. He scored 50. And so he beat me by like three points, you know? I have like 1906 and he has like 1909, you know, in the career. So, but we were rivals. So anytime we played a game, it was the fire marshals had to dang near come. They had to open the doors so people could stand outside and watch. The gyms were just at absolute capacity. Mm-hmm. And his name was Andre Woolridge. And we ended up going to Nebraska together, but then he ended up going to Iowa, transferring to Iowa. And he had a great career. He ended up being Big Ten Player of the Year, I think his senior year. And so he had a really good career, played overseas, I think a little bit in the D League. Mm-hmm. But that was my rival. And it was just anytime we got together, it was going to be the talk of the town.
Definitely. No, that sounds great. And would you say, Eric, that you had a coach or somebody in high school that you really leaned on and was a mentor for you?
Yeah, his name was my coach's name was Lanny Richards. Mm-hmm. And Lanny's son, his name is Bill Richards. And I, as an eighth grader, I got a chance to go and kind of watch them. And he was a lefty like me. He was really silky. And he had one of the smoothest left-hand finger rolls that I used to be like, ooh, I need that in my repertoire. You know what I mean? And I liked him. And it was his dad. His dad was my coach. Mm-hmm. So that drew me to Bellevue West and Lanny. But then to watch Lanny take me in as a father figure at different times and really speak life into me. But what I loved about him, and I'll give you an example, is I had kind of a hitch in my shot. And Lanny understanding where I was going, not where I was at, that he was always looking at me and trying to figure out aspects of my game to help make me better. And with that hitch from the side, it was a push. It was going to be inconsistent. So he wanted to move it more to, you know, to the front of my face, more of an L. I kind of had a flying elbow. And he said, we're going to break that. And I, you know, most people want to come in the gym, get the ball, go straight to the hoop, you know, start, you know, shooting up jumpers deep. You know, that's how kids start. He's like, nah, you're not going to start that way. One, you're going to not shoot at the rim until I tell you to. So for you, every day, even before practice, at PE or something, you've got to get a ball. You've got to hold it in one hand. So if you have the flying elbow, it's going to fall out. So I had to learn how to tuck it. And he's like, we're gonna pick a spot up on the wall, not at the basket, on the wall. And you've got to shoot the ball to that spot 100 times a day. So it helped kill my flying elbow. And then he started showing me the progression drills from shooting under the rim. So I made sure I had a nice high arc on my shot instead of a flat shot. And then I would progressively move back. And so he taught me aspects of the game that would make me better in being a better and more consistent shooter, being a better free throw shooter. He taught me defensive concepts that weren't being taught in high school at that higher level, rotations, passing lanes, playing off the ball, all of these different three things he was teaching us at an early age. That's what made me more ready for college than most people coming into college. So that was Lanny Richards, and he was the one that inspired me to be a better me from a young age, as a man and as a player.
That's awesome. It looks like it translated. I mean, you're a career 83% free throw shooter, career 35% three-point shooter. Yeah, so that's cool that someone caught that just in time before you got into the big stage and you got to iron that out through college and stuff. That's huge.
Yeah. The next person would be at the NBA level. Well, the next person at the college level would be a guy by the name of Jeff Smith. He was one of my coaches. And then at the NBA level, I really valued the relationship because he made me, he probably helped me to have the best career year. And that was Kiki Vandeweghe.
Wow.
Kiki Vandeweghe was the one that really helped me hone in on my footwork and just creativity around the basket and creating space, because Kiki wasn't the most athletic guy, but he knew how to create space and get buckets. And he had me right.
Definitely. Wow. And, you said too, you mentioned, Lanny, he, got you ready right away for, your first year over at Nebraska, and you were the Big Eight at the time, freshman player of the year. Could you just kind of talk a little bit about that year and, you transitioning and, what was, you had success in and what you kind of, had to work at?
So early on, it really was, I understood this part is I understood seniority. I understood patience. I understood that even though I was coming in with the name and the recognition that I had, I still understood there was a hierarchy. So how can I break through that hierarchy in the most efficient way, except with my mouth and my tongue, trying to be a bad seed and apple for the team? And I said, defense is my mark. So I always felt that if I can make a defensive impact or change the pace of the game or do something, that would create more opportunities for me to get on the court and stay on the court in crucial moments or crucial times, or when something's needed to get done, they would have to look to me for that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how, I looked at it from that standpoint, and that's what helped me to get on the court. And that's what sparked all aspects of my game. If I got into it defensively, or I took a challenge, or I knew I was going to be playing a Chauncey Billups or a Donnie Boyce or you know, a Fred Hoiberg, you know, I took that challenge and getting after them and shutting them down, or even Jason Kidd when we did have AAU tournament. Those things, I think that's, I mean, we'll get into that. You may want to touch on that when we get to the NBA stuff, because I would venture to say that's probably the greatest gift that was to me, is that the Mavericks wanted me, and I wasn't like a lot of people scared of Jason Kidd. You know, he didn't scare me like most people. But yeah, that's how that was.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. What did you always know that you were going to Nebraska, or was it kind of like a decision that you know, that came late? Or
no, it wasn't a late decision. It was very early, one of my teammates, Terrence Badgett, he was ahead of me by 1 year. He ended up going, and so I'd spend a lot of time down with him. He had his own room. I'd go down, stay on campus with him. We always played in the summer, so I was very comfortable. But what really also helped was that Nebraska the year before was ranked in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a really good team that year. And I think they were even second in the Big Eight that year. And so they were rolling. So it was a fun style of basketball. They were very physical. They ran. The score was going to be 80s, 90s every game. So it was a really fun style that Danny Lee created. And so I knew pretty early, I wanted to get that process done early. I wanted to be able to focus on the sport and not have to worry about the recruiting parts that come with it. So I knew pretty early that I was going to choose Nebraska. A lot of people knew that. Nebraska football was good. So in case I wanted to cross over, you know, I knew I had that good Allen Iverson.
Yeah, do a little at Antonio Gates, do a little tight end wide receiver hybrid, a little point guard.
actually, to be honest, Mike, I probably would have played defense. I was a hitter. I would have either been an outside linebacker or a strong safety. Nice. You know, Cam Chancellor type.
Yeah, that'd be terrifying. It'd be holding it down back there for sure. I think it's super underrated, especially back then. You know, Nebraska's always talked about as the football school, but their basketball programs really good. It was really good, especially through the 90s there. You also played with another guy who went undrafted and still had a pretty awesome career, Mikey Moore. He was a running mate there at Nebraska. Any fun stories made from practice or games or you know, campus with Mikey back in the day?
Mikey was and probably is still kind of weak, right? Mikey, like, he liked reptiles, and, you know, he kind of kept to himself, and, you know, you go over and you might see a snake on the floor. I mean, he's always been like, he just like cars, and, you know, he was different, but he was one of the coolest, most humble guys ever, right? But I do have one where, I mean, there was a lot of us that were a part of this, and probably me least, because I understood flying. And I kind of wanted to get my pilot's license, but it just, with NBA contracts back then, that could nullify, doing stuff like that can nullify your contract if something was to happen. So I didn't want to do that. But we had a game where we were playing in Minnesota, and we're on a plane. It was probably like a Hawkeye. It was a two engine propeller plane, 20 seater. Mikey was probably in the back middle because he had the longest legs. And so I'm sitting in front with the pilot because it was a one pilot. So he allowed me to sit in the front and just kind of help him with the radios. You know, I kind of got to change the radios over, not, you know, anything where I was doing anything with the mechanism, but he let me do the radios. So I'm sitting in front, and it was a blizzardy day. And you're hitting air pockets that you're dropping 3, 5, 8, 10,000 feet at times, which is like a huge roller coaster ride. And so all I can hear up front, I hear people saying and making a noise, but all I can hear is Mikey in the back. Oh my God! Oh no! No, we're gonna die! Oh Lord! That's all I can hear. can hear is Mikey, and I don't think I ever let him let him hear that down. I said, "You little crying little people." And I bugged him about that forever. But yeah, that's all. That's probably one of the funny things I remember about Mikey is that plane ride to Minnesota. And I tell you, the crosswinds were crazy. Mm-hmm. I think I watched one of the greatest pilots I felt in my life because the crosswinds were 30, 40 knots. And I'm telling you, he had the yaw like all the way. So if you have a regular yaw like this, mm-hmm. he had the yaw all the way like this just to keep the plane from, you know, dipping this way. He had to keep it, and he was ruddering hard. And he landed that thing, and we were sliding. It was blizzardy. We kind of were sliding. And I said, yo, all I could do is, yo, you're amazing to land this plane the way you just did. So.
Yeah, I mean, that was on the way to the game. Did you guys win the game?
We were going to Minnesota. Yeah, we actually won. Yeah,
nice. Yeah, I would assume. How was the trip back? Was the flight a little bit better, or was it?
Yeah, it was better going back.
Okay,
yeah, it was better going back. Awesome. Even though it was still snow on the ground, it wasn't it blizzardy.
Yeah, absolutely.
That next day, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Mikey's the man. I remember him as a Celtic, obviously. Yourself too, at a little stint there. But no, that's cool to hear. Yeah, definitely. Well,
Mikey figured it out, man. What he did, he figured out his strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing. He did not do anything outside of his strength.
Yep.
He knew, I'm going to set strong screens. I'm going to roll. I'm going to be able to knock this 15-footer down, and I'm going to rebound and run. That's what he did, and that's what helped him to have a good long career in the NBA. No question.
Sure. You also had when you were a senior, you had Ty Lue as a freshman. And you know, everyone always talks about, oh, the point guard that you can always tell from a young age they're going to be a coach someday. Did you kind of sense that with Ty, like right off the bat when he came in freshman year? Or was that something he kind of developed, you know, under your wing, maybe?
I would say Ty developed it. Ty was very quiet,
mm-hmm.
so I was very much a leader. Actually, that year, I probably was the closest ever to quitting playing basketball. And they say a lot of people say that it was a mutiny and stuff like that against Coach Yee. You know, if you did your backstories on that, but it really wasn't. It was really a team that was lost. We started out like 11-1. We lost a tough game. You know, I think maybe at Iowa State or something. And then we lost like 10 straight. And it was just a lot of what we used to have in camaraderie and unison. We started having clicking.
Yeah.
So there was this click and that click. And this click talked about that one. And this one didn't like that one because they thought this one was getting too much for that. And so we literally didn't have the unity. We had the talent. Uh-huh. We probably were the most talented team in the Big Eight that year, but we just could not win. And when I started seeing our second team just continuously beat us, I almost quit. Like, I basically said F you to all of you. I don't need none of you, you know, type of thing. And it wasn't, again, my mentor Jeff Smith, if it wasn't for him talking me off the ledge, I probably was out. So then we ended up finishing the year. We made a good run at the end. Lost a tough game to Kansas State, I think, in the Big Eight tournament. But we got invited to the NIT. And so with Ty Lue, that whole season, he's quiet. But he showed it on the court. He led on the court. He didn't do it vocally. He didn't do it by, you know, I was probably more of a vocal leader than him. But he just played his tail off. He gave everything and left everything on the court. So that aspect of him, I think, was developed when he was in the NBA once he got under Doc Rivers. I really think Doc helped him, you know, when he was coaching him, you know, helped him to hone some of those skills from that manner. Definitely.
And too, like in during that season, Coach, like when you were talking with your mentor, you know, as far as your thought process, you know, was there anything that you could kind of, you know, share with some players that are kind of going through that now that you would have handled differently?
I don't think we should have walked out of, you know, maybe practiced or expressed our feelings more vocally. I thought the meeting that we had that helped turn our season around as to when we won the NIT, I think when we sat in, and I, you know, I kind of had to lead that meeting a little bit, and we all took ownership and leadership in some aspects, but, you know, I really just wanted to get to the point where, look, each and every one of us at this moment right here, we need to look each other in the face. And whatever issue you have against that person, address it right now, deal with it right now, and squash it, and it's over. And let's go. This see the rest of this season, it's not about Coach Knee. It's not about the – it's about us. Let's finish it the way we want it to look and not the way people are trying to portray it to look, you know, based on what they perceive has happened, right? And we left out of there, and that's where it changed for us. So I would say we probably could have handled that a little bit differently, maybe than the way we did, the way we vocalized things, maybe our emotions. But a lot of stuff I wouldn't change.
Absolutely, yeah, because it seems like at least it came from the heart, you know, and you guys really meant what you said, and that's what it really shows, true leadership. And, you know, your story is amazing in that end, because it's like, even when you're up against the wall or your back's against it, it was never an option to quit. And it was always to rally everybody. So, you know, that's something that I hope that people, if you're an athlete or if, you know, you're a leader, to know that you have to, no matter what, you can't really, you know, fall, and you have to, you know, pull up your bootstraps and keep going. So that I,
Yeah, ended up winning the NIT MVP that season, ended it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, you know, nobody expected that. You know, they expected us to fall off the map. But we turned that thing around, and I guarantee you there was nobody that wanted to play us during that stretch. We went and beat, you know, Fresno State was like one of those ones that was in but out, but they were really good, and they were – giving people fits, and we went in there and we demolished them, you know, Tarkanian. We beat a solid Colorado State team. Then I think we came home and beat, I want to say, maybe it was Penn State or somebody like that. I can't remember exactly. But then we went out to New York, and I think playing in the Garden, we played Tulane. Tulane had a really good team that year. Also, they were very athletic and talented. And we played them in the semis. And then we played St. Joe's in the finals. And it was a hard-fought game. Yeah. And I think, for me, when we made it to the Madison, that's when I saw I can be here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the dreams of what I saw, you know, even though you played on ESPN and all these different big games, I think when I played at Madison Square Garden and then ended up being the MVP, I think that's when I realized I can be here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so it definitely seems like a blessing, you know, being in that tournament and being able in that venue, you know, and being able to see yourself there. And when you did, was there a moment, or, you know, would you daydream at all while looking up at the rafters in that? Could you tell us a little bit about the experience?
Facts. There was a video out, and I think the camera was on me at one time, and I said, yeah, we in Madison Square Garden, baby. I said, I hope to be here one day. And, you know, I just remember looking up, and we had more fans there than even St. Joe, and they were from Philly.
Yeah.
And you know, looking up and just seeing all of that red and seeing just, you know, man, this is the Mecca. You know what I'm saying? This is, you know, and then you walk down the halls and you see all the concerts and you see all the big Knick games that have been played in there. And you're like, man, this is it, bro. This is it. Oh, yeah. So to not only have played there, played for the Knicks, and to you know, have played in there many a times, you know, it was awe-inspiring, definitely.
Hell yeah.
That's awesome. It's going to be a confidence boost and something that powered you through kind of the draft process and stuff. So this whole time while you're playing Nebraska, you're also balancing that with playing baseball, right, in the summers?
First couple of years.
First couple of years. Okay. So
yeah, my entrance and then going into my sophomore year.
Nice. No, that's got to be a tough balance for sure. When you entered the draft process, you ended up going undrafted. Did you ever consider going back to baseball, or did the Mavericks kind of hit you up right after the draft and say, like, hey, we know you didn't get picked, come on down to training camp kind of thing?
So I don't want to sit here and act like I'm the smartest guy on earth, by no means. I don't want to sit here and act like, you know, I put all the chess pieces in the right spot to where I could get the queen and boom, secure the king. I'm not going to sit here and act like that. I just want to say that God blessed me with truly having good people around me that spoke life to me, right? So one of my coaches, his name was Carlos Tosca for the Florida Marlins. He ended up being a head coach at some point and spending a good career. But Carlos Tosca, he sat me down and he said, yo, Strick, listen, you're a top 10 prospect for our organization. He says, I think you'll be a hell of an MLB player. I also think you're a good enough athlete that you would be a hell of an NBA player. He says, but I need to tell you, we want to move you up. We want to move you and send you to Kane County, which was the AA team. But we need you playing in the winter. We need you playing full time. So here's my advice, or here's what I would like to, you know, place an option on your behalf. If you decide to go the basketball route, he says, and it doesn't work out, we'll welcome you back with open arms. You can come back anytime. He says, if you decide to go baseball, we would need you to not play basketball, and we need to have you going full time, because we want you to have full, you know, spring training, because we want to progress you. I said, okay. And I made the choice, and the choice was basketball. So being undrafted, I still pursued it, and I had a lot of naysayers, and I just worked my butt off. I think I'd go in the gym. I took everything the naysayers said about me, whether it was in pre-draft camps or playing in these little leagues, you know, these different types of leagues. And I took all of that ammunition, and I was in the gym two, three times a day, working on those specific issues, from the weight room to working to shooting consistency, making my shot quicker, all of these things I was working on. And I continually got no's. I got to summer league with the Indiana Pacers, and actually Donnie Walsh, who just retired not too long ago, had been a longtime president for the Indiana Pacers. He had admittedly sat me in his office and said, he said, Eric, we missed it the first time. We had a lot of influential people telling us this and that about you, but we know we missed it, and we're glad to have you back. That's when they brought me back. And this is where you should have been from the beginning. But what had happened was, I went to summer league. I think it was me, Travis Best. I was backing up Travis Best that year. And we played in the LA summer league. And I played well. But again, I wasn't Travis Best type. So Larry Brown's brother, Herb Brown was his name, he didn't like me because I wasn't Mark Jackson-ish. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying? He wanted me to just be, you know, he just wanted me to be traditional point guard. And I wasn't that, you know what I mean? So I was getting buckets. I was being creative. I was getting to the free throw line. I was dishing, but I wasn't doing it the way he wanted it. And so he basically talked me out of me getting that earlier contract. So, but what happened was, is going through that process, there was the math scout named Ron Aker saw me. And he says, we want to invite you to vet camp. And I asked the question, as I did, because I'm just not oh, yeah. I'm like, do I have a legitimate shot to make this team? You know, I don't want to just come in and be a body. You know what I mean? I mean, I can go anywhere and do that. Do I have a legitimate shot? He said, yes, you do. We have new ownership. We have new coach. Nobody's contracts are guaranteed. And if you looked at it on paper, there was 15 guaranteed contracts. Mm-hmm. So really, I didn't have a chance. I mean, if you looked at it by guaranteed contract standard. So I went in, and again, before I went to college, we played an AAU tournament. And to get to the semifinals, we were in the final eight. We played Jason Kidd's team. They had 2 7-footers. Jason Kidd, I mean, they were, and we didn't have no 7-footers. We maybe had a 6'10 kid and just a bunch of scrap, but we can shoot. You know, there was a bunch of us that could penetrate, and they had shooters, and we were just busting their heads. But I locked Jason down. Jason locked me down. I locked him down. He had 5 points. I maybe had 5-2. You know what I'm saying? Or 3. You know what I mean? I didn't score. But Andy, my partner, Andy Warbridge, had like 40. So it was like, whatever. Go. And so for me, when I said Dallas Mavericks, Jason Kidd, I shut him down. I'm not scared of him. And I was like, it's a bet. Let's go. Got in there, of course, me and Jason almost got in a couple fights because, you know, I'm 94 feet. He trying to chill. And I'm like, I ain't chill. I'm trying to get a job. You know what I mean? I ain't no chill to me, bro. Whatever. Whatever. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of how I got my job. And you know, bless God, Ross Perot sat my dad and I down. Ross Perot being a former military guy, Ross Perot Jr. being a former military guy, got a chance to see my dad, looked across at me, saw what I was doing. He said, you know, I want that type of man on my team. So he cut 3 contracts, almost $2 million, and signed me. So that's nice. That's how I got there.
That is.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, no, and that too, you talk about, you know, just your style of play and just what has kind of come out with this new, you know, type of guards and combo guards and hybrid guards, you know. So it does show like your game was there. And it always was. It's just this prototype that people had in their mind that now we're starting to see people are starting to shift. And, you know, they're not worried about, well, damn, if you're only 6'3", but what can you add to the game and how can you impact?
Right.
So, yes.
Yeah. And so to speak to that point, mm-hmm. So they didn't know that. They didn't know that. They too was looking at point guard. So it was me. I think Derek Harper was there, mm-hmm. Jason Kidd. And so, of course, there wasn't a lot of reps. It wasn't a lot of reps at the just traditional point guard mm-hmm. position. So I think like Tony Dumas, Jimmy King, I think Mash went down. We had like some injuries, right? So I had been telling them, yo, man, I'll guard Jimmy Jackson. I'll guard blah, blah, blah. I'll guard Mash, you know what I'm saying? They're like, nah. You know, because they're just looking at me like 6'3", you know what I'm saying? Like, nah. And so finally they were like, okay, Strick, you guard Jimmy, you know, so we can work.
Yeah.
And when they saw me guard Jimmy, they were like, we might have something here. Yeah. A versatile guy that can, yo. So then they began to see it. That's why, as when I played in my career, I've guarded everybody from Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Tim Duncan in the fourth quarter. Nelly was crazy, man. I'm telling you, Nelly was a mad scientist.
Oh, yeah.
Nelly saw that we had a mismatch disadvantage against the Spurs with Duncan and Robinson. He's like, Sean Bradley, I can't play him against these guys. They kill him. So he went with a rotation lineup of me, maybe Steve Nash. That's when Steve was in the game. Mm-hmm. Or me, Seth Sabalas, Michael Finley, Dirk, AC Green, and that would be our 5. Mm-hmm. So I would guard Tim Duncan. AC would guard Robinson. said would guard Sean Elliott. Michael Finley would guard Mario Elie, and Nash would guard the little general. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, because he didn't really, you know, so that wasn't a risk because Steve could play off of him and help and do all of that. Mm-hmm. So, I'm guarding Tim, but because, remember, back then, you couldn't get away with that now. But back then, you could because I could be physical. So, I would push Tim. Tim didn't really want to be at the block. He wanted to be kind of at the, you know, just kind of off the block where he could face you up and, you know, jab you and hit you with the bank or jab you one to the middle with a hook and jab you spin off you. You know, that was his stuff. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't do that with me, right? Because I would press him. I would get up under him, hope he puts it down because now he's in my space. Yeah. You know, I might be able to get them cookies. So I would keep him far enough off to where I could challenge his turnarounds or challenge all of that, and then I could box him out, keep him far enough away so I could, you know, help on rebound. But this is Nelly's thinking. Eric can handle him enough here to not let him get to his advantage, but how are they going to guard us?
Yeah.
And that's how we beat them, because at the other end, we took them out of there. They had to basically put one of them on the bench.
Yeah.
They had to come mm-hmm. to us. They had to match up with us because we took away their advantage by doing something so, abnormal that it caused them to switch to us, which then now that's our game. That's how we were able to beat them.
That's awesome. That's that reminds me of the...
I even guarded Shaq, bro, for like 5 minutes. But imagine how that went, right? So now mind you, Mad scientist Nelly didn't come up with this, right? This is me looking from the bench. I'm sitting on the bench at this time. I was a starter at that time, but I came off. So I'm watching Shaq just 1, 2, rah! You Shaq Bradley 2 feet out the way and just crashing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you got to see the video, you know, Shaq crashing like that. I'll be going to the middle and pow, just all of that.
Yeah.
So I'm like, no, I'm not gonna curse on your show, but I'm gonna tell you what he said.
You're welcome.
I said, fucking Nelly, come in on him. I didn't think he was gonna do it. I said that I didn't think he was gonna do it, but he said, stick it in there, go guard. So I get in there, I'm like, oh snap. I think I just stepped in some boo-boo. I don't know if I can get out of this one. So mind you, I'm physically up to Shaq. And he's looking back at me like, where's this little man right here? This little man, this little man. And he's looking at me and he's like, are they serious right now?
Yeah.
So of course, I'm the charge king. If you would have taken charge stats back when I was playing in my early stage, I by far would have a record. Like I would get at least 2-3 charges a game. You know, it was crazy. So he looks back and of course he's gonna try to go deep on me, right? Because he's like, he's leveraging me up, you crazy. So I waited for him to do that and then
the
charges. So I got him a couple fouls and helped to get him out of the game a little bit quicker than usual.
That's incredible. That those last couple stories remind me of someone very specific that I'm a very big fan of in the NBA that I think has a similar type to you. Is there anybody that specifically reminds you of yourself out there playing today? Because there's a guy on the Celtics that makes me think about you a bit.
Marcus is very similar. I would say PJ Tucker has maybe not as good footwork, but you know, just getting after you physically. I think I had some touches of Patrick Beverley without the mouth. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
A little more muscle than Bev. Like
I mean, of course, I modeled myself after Gary Payton. So, you know, see his son now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, very much like his son. Very much like his son.
Yeah, he's blowing up the last few weeks here. He's playing really well. But, yeah, you mentioned the mad scientist, Don Nelson, one of our favorite old hoop coaches. What was it like? You guys kind of both got to Dallas at the same time, kind of getting used to your new space. Did you kind of lean on him a little bit as a rookie and he kind of, you know, embrace you in that role as, you know, the defensive dog?
Well, Jim Clemens was the coach initially, right? Mm-hmm. So they had some transitions. They ended up bringing in Don Nelson probably about halfway through the season, January timeframe. Don got busy right away. I mean, Don, well, I think even while I was still there, not Don, but they got rid of Jason Kidd early, made that trade, brought in Michael Finley, I think, and Steve Nash and that group. No, I think that was when Don came. So, yeah, that was when that happened. So what happened was I got cut in my rookie year. So I was on the bench. I made the team, but I wasn't playing. So I ended up going to the CBA. I go to the CBA and I play for the Oklahoma City. I can't remember their name, but I was in Oklahoma City in the CBA. I wasn't playing. Coach had his guys, and Ryan Miner was on the team at that time. He ended up being a good baseball player. He played some basketball for Oklahoma, and all of a sudden, I have to make a decision. I go to the coach and I'm like, listen, coach, I don't plan to be a career CBA player. I said, I understand you've got your team and your players. Either you have to find a way for me into this rotation because I plan on going back. I don't plan on staying here. Mm-hmm. Or you have to trade me. So he traded me. I went over to Quad Cities. I ended up playing backup behind Rick Brunson, who is Jalen Brunson's dad for the Mavericks. Mm-hmm. Rick Brunson, we ended up playing together on a lot of different teams in New York, Dallas. I mean, we ended up playing together quite a bit. But Rick, I was his backup, but then all of a sudden I started going nuts from the backup. I mean, I started averaging like 21, 25. And then, I had multiple games where I just got busy. And then my last game, I think I had like 30-something or 30 or 40 in Grand Rapids. And then that's when I got the call before we went to our next trip from the Mavericks. And Don had called and said they wanted to call me back. And so they called me up. So I flew straight from there to Vancouver to meet the team. The greatest blessing with that was they had made the largest trade at that time of eight players, an eight-player trade. So we only had seven people on the roster about to play Vancouver and Sacramento the next 2 days. So I said, this is my opportunity because they've got to play me. It's not like, they can just sit me over here and they got all these guys, they're just coming, but they've got to play me. So the first game against Vancouver, I think I had like 12 points and, like five assists and, just had a solid game. The next night we played against Sacramento, and they started me, but they started me at the two. So it was me, Derek Harper. I don't know who we had at the three at the time. I think, was Dirk there? No, Dirk wasn't there yet. I don't know who we had at the three at the time and our four and five before AC came, before Mike Finley, before Nash, before all of them came, right? So I had like 25 points. And I shut Mitch Richmond down to 21. I never came off the court again after that.
Facts.
I started the rest of the season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's awesome. Being able to – the defensive, being able to come in and do that as well as the scoring piece. Like, that is what so many coaches I know have said. Like, if you come in here and defend and, to play that role, that's so amazing to hear that's how, you really, made your mark in the game. And I love that you used it as an opportunity where some people would, be down about it, and that's such a cool story to hear for real. Like, mm-hmm. That is awesome, man.
I mean, maybe MJ aside, I guess, since that's probably the easiest answer, but who would you say was the toughest guy you ever had to defend?
A lot of people ask that question, right? And I surprised them. MJ and Kobe are very similar. They have mm-hmm. counters for days. They're going to, with them, it's not even about that you're going to stop them. It's that you just got to hope they have an off night. You just got to be there, challenge, and hope that they're not on. That's the kind of players they were, right? For me, people would think it's a Baron Davis or They would think it's Allen Iverson, or they think it's, you know, those types, right? I'll give you four, and both of them are two different types of players that I hated guarding. One, I hated guarding, and two, the second one was just, they were tough for me, right? The likes of Nick Van Exel and Damon Stoudemire. Oh, yeah. Those type of players, not just because they're lefties, that has nothing to do with it, but they're herky-jerky. Yes. They don't have a pattern to their style. You know what I mean? They're like a kung fu master with no pattern. You know what I mean? They have drunken boxing. They have monkey style. They have, you know what I mean? They have all these different, there's no pattern. So they're here, there, they're everywhere. They're, you know, I'm like, where are you going? You know what I'm saying? That type of thing. Those type of players. I also felt Rod Strickland was very tough. Mm-hmm. He had great trick bag, strong. He put his hand on you. He'd get by you. It was simplistic, but he'd give you that work. Mm-hmm. And the other types I hated was Reggie Miller and Rip Hamilton types.
Yeah.
The ones that didn't stop. They ran all day, and they had 100 screens. And so you've got to transverse 100 different screens. They're always jogging, running, moving. I hated those type of players.
Thanks. Yeah. No, what kind of went into preparing, you know, to handle those players? Did you watch extra film? Would you have players, you know, act like they were during practice? What was it that helped you prepare for those tough matchups?
You got to remember, I told you mm-hmm. that I was very visible. I have a, you know, very imaginative, you know, so I visualize what they're doing. You know, film was different back then. Now you just pull up your iPad and go to Synergy or something, and you can pull up any type of set and this, where they had to, like, it took time for them to break down those things and put them on, you know, shoot, VHS. We had VHS back then. And, you know, it was tough. So most of it was scouting reports. So I was very thorough on looking at the scouting reports, what they did the game before, or what type of role they're on. You know, if they're shooting the ball well, so my job was to make sure they got uncomfortable early. So I would just visualize those types of things. Understanding their sets based off the plays they like to run and where this particular person that I had to guard would like to probably get his shots and feel most comfortable. I'm trying to take him out of that. So those are the things that I did.
Nice. Yeah, it's definitely would have been a nice advantage if, you know, we could just hop on Synergy on the iPad there and back in the day on the road, you know, on the flight over. I got a random one for you that I kind of just stumbled across while looking up YouTube videos and stuff. Do you remember the video that you did with Kurt Thomas about post entries in 1997?
Oh, wow. No.
Someone uploaded it to YouTube the last couple months here. So if you want a little walk down memory lane of you doing some coaching tips, it's not very long, but it's pretty cool. It was pretty funny to see. So if you know, type in your name on YouTube and it comes up as one of the first results, someone just uploaded it. So I thought that was pretty cool. Getting the science behind, you know, the wraparounds and stuff for the post entries for the big man, which every point guard's got to know. And you had him down, yeah, for sure. So that's cool. So you ended up at the Knicks for your second stop, right?
Yeah, I got traded to the Knicks. And then I got traded to I literally don't claim that next one. That midseason trade to Vancouver. I don't claim that one. That was probably the, you know, great people, great city. Yeah. But I don't claim that. I think I gave away that jersey. I could probably sell that jersey. I'd go to Vancouver, probably sell that today and make some money. But
heck yeah.
I got rid of that one.
So then you ended up on the my hometown Celtics the next year. How did that all come about? What was it like? You know, I know it was only a year there, but playing with the C's, with Pierce and Tuan.
Loved every bit of it, and I loved it because we're a hodgepodge group of guys with two extremely talented and one super talented but kind of older guy in Kenny. But everybody predicted us to be at the bottom of the East. And we had chips on our shoulders and we were going to show people. And, you know, I was just glad they brought me in. I had an agent that was telling me a whole bunch of stuff. I fired him, had an agent stepped up and was like, I was out working out with Magic Johnson in LA. I didn't even go to training camp. I didn't go to the Celtics training camp. I was sitting there playing and he's talking to me. I think I was playing at UCLA or something. And he's like, why are you still here? And I'm like, man, you know, my agent was saying this, ain't nobody call, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's like, hold on, man, I'm gonna call you tonight. He calls me, he's like, nobody's called you. I'm like, no. He's like, you got an agent? Yeah. I had to fire my agent. And I hired him. And he's like, man, Boston wants you, bro. I said, what? He's like, yeah, Boston wants you. I was like, cool, boom. Da-da-da. I was on my way to Boston. I showed up probably second game of the season and went straight in and boom, the rest is history. But we had chips on our shoulders, man. We was grimy. We got after people. Like, the only part about that I hate is that Jim O'Brien deferred to relationships as opposed to what had got him there. So obviously he had a relationship with Tony Delk, but what helped us to beat New Jersey wasn't Tony Delk. It was the rotation with me covering Kid, and that's how we 3-1 them. You know what I mean? I took Kid out and made everybody else have to do other things, and he didn't go back to that. What was successful? Yeah, I hated it because it you know, we ended up losing. I don't think we should have lost to New Jersey, to be honest.
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, that was a pretty awesome playoff run, probably the best playoff run other than that 08 run, you know, until the 08 run with the championship, yeah. Obviously, for the Seas. Lots of big comebacks in the run. You know, the big, the Nets team was really good. Is there any sort of, like, you know, stories from that year that still stick with you, whether it's playoffs or, you know, the development of Pierce into a, you know, obviously he was really good, but he kind of took the next step of being like, oh, this guy's going to be a big time scorer forever.
Yeah, no, I knew Paul was going to be who Paul was. Paul was an assassin. He didn't look like he'd give you the work he's going to give you. He looked like he was unathletic and slow, and he did everything just so melodic and just easy. But he giving you 30. You know what I mean? Antoine, I think the best thing that Jim O'Brien did was having a sit down with them and helping them to learn to trust. Because by them trusting, they still could do what they do, but trusting us, the other guys, Kenny Anderson, Eric Williams, me, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To make the play or to make the shot when it's there, once they got to that point, that's what helped us to have the success that we did.
Definitely. Yeah, and I remember, too, that team because I was like a Bulls, major Bulls fan, and when Jordan retired, I was kind of like trying to find a team, and I remember that Celtics squad and just how hard you guys played. And honestly, it helped me, you know, with my game because I was always a small player, and, you know, I was trying to find ways to impact the game and guarding the better players and shutting that team's point guard down. Is always the best way to start, especially when point guards get everybody involved, like you said, you know. So I definitely took a page out of your book because I definitely remember you as a player. And
thank you.
Yeah, no, definitely, because I was like 12, 13 years old at that time, so I was really trying to figure out how I could impact the game because I knew I wasn't going to grow as much anymore. So that was definitely a big piece in my life. I don't know. Was there would you say that there was any coach in the NBA that would that kind of really influenced you that gave you a lot of
Don Nelson?
Don
Nelson. Ooh. I mean, I told you why. Don probably was the coach even to this day that believed in me. Matter of fact, he didn't even want to trade. They did some old back. You know, actually, it was his son. It was little Don. It was little Donnie getting in the. You know, Cuban's ear. I think that's kind of that is strange their relationship for a little while. little Donnie backdooring and getting close to Cuban and doing things, because Big Don didn't want to trade me. That wasn't his doing. That's why I still love him to this day.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, we're big fans of his post career, his farming now, as it is called. Yeah. So that's always cool.
Yeah, beat cancer. You know, living down there in Maui, doing his thing, man. He's awesome.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
I guess the silver lining of losing to New Jersey that year, you didn't have to play defense on Shaq in the finals ever, right?
Yeah. No, that was a great turnover. And our philosophy with them, we knew we couldn't stop Shaq. You know what I mean? Our philosophy was, we're going to make Kobe shoot 30 times a game.
Yeah.
And, we're going to let Kobe shoot them out. That was how we would beat them. You know what I mean? We would just hone in on Shaq and make Kobe – we let Kobe go nuts, shut everybody else down, and hone in on Shaq. That was our game plan.
But so I know you got some stuff going on this afternoon, so we don't want to keep you too long. We don't want you having to rush out. But talk about kind of your post playing days and the I know you did a little coaching. You helped out with the Mavs organization for a little bit. Then you started a company. You got a radio show. What's post basketball career? Eric Strickland's been a very busy and successful man in his own right. So run us through some of your post playing fun.
Yeah, I just tried to stay busy. I refereed. I did college, high school basketball, as you spoke. I, started a couple of things. A company that had luxury boy toys at one time, which was a phenomenal idea. Just, I think that was right around the time 08 hit. And, it was just rough for everybody around that time. So it just didn't get off the ground in a great way. I never saw myself doing like what you guys do. I mean, I know I like to talk about things. And I enjoy that. But I kind of am a background guy, man. That's why I work for the Mavericks in the background. I didn't even work in the foreground with them. I kind of am cool being in the background, support roles. So refereeing was fun because it kept me close to the game. I got a chance to impact the game in a way. Coaching got frustrating for me because kids just didn't have the same passion, energy that I had for the game. So I didn't want to, bring that part to them because I didn't want to fault them for what they didn't bring that was similar to me. So I just got tired of dealing with parents and dealing with all those things. So now I got into E-Play, sat down with guys named Ryan Gerardo and Charles Gaines, and we began discussing some things and what they was trying to do and what they were trying to build. And they wanted to do it by way of app at first. So it started as an app, but what I saw in it was guys like me getting missed. Guys like Dwayne Wade getting missed. Guys like Ja Morant got missed. And so what way can we help these type of players to not be missed? They didn't get missed ultimately, but they got missed on the onset, because how does Murray State get a Ja Morant?
Right. Right.
You gotta really ask that question. It wasn't like some of them now are just going to HBCUs like they are now. Some of them like Shaq's son is doing, but no, at that time, he just happened to never make it to the top courts that most of the top coaches were watching games. He just happened to be in the back end. Murray State coach ends up going back there trying to, find a concession stand or a restroom, sees this kid killing everybody. Coach, you need to get down here. How can we make that happen on an analytical and number set scale so that now when you're looking, and then COVID actually helped our business model, because now when you can't go out and see kids, you're relying on the verbal aspects of scouts and all these people, which at times can be biased because sometimes they're getting greased. So, they're pushing a certain person or a certain kid, whatever the case may be. Whereas we want to bring empirical data to the scene to help a coach say, okay, this and back in my time there was more loyalty. So if I said I'm going to Nebraska, I'm going to Nebraska. Now I could tell you I'm coming to Nebraska, but really I'm telling Kansas, I'm telling Oregon, and I'm telling UCLA I'm all going to them, and they're all hyped and they think they got me, and they may start passing on certain people and they end up getting. That's why the transfer portal was so crazy, right? Because you end up getting or acquiring people that not necessarily you really believe or want or need, you got your second, third tier guy that you already have somebody, and they end up frustrated, so they end up going to perk. You know, so that's kind of what happens. But we want to be able to help coaches to say, to basically shoot sniper rifles instead of machine guns. Mm-hmm. So now you miss out on this particular guy, but there's another one in Kenosha and one in Spokane, Washington, that have the similar archetype to the one that you missed, but you just don't see that because he's not a part of your pipeline. That Spokane kid is not a part of your pipeline. So now you can tell a coach, okay, get out there. They've got tournaments playing at this, this, this. Go check this kid out. And now you get a chance to put your eyes on a kid, and you may not even know that that kid maybe had a father or a grandfather that went to your school. He loved it. He would have loved to have gone to your school, but you didn't touch him because you never seen him. You didn't know nothing about him. So we're trying to help these type of stories to be that's what we did at ePlay and now, which is Cerebral Sports, is what they're doing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's very much a cool idea. And, you know, using the data and the, you know, technology at our disposal to not let people fall through the cracks as much is definitely, you know, you got NIL involved.
Yeah, because they can't get on the NIU circuit.
Yeah. Or, oh, yeah.
You know, they just don't have the monetary means to play mm-hmm. on a super AAU circuit, or they don't get invited to the Adidas Gauntlet circuit or to the Nike EYBL circuit or, you know, the Under Armour circuit. They don't have that connection. They just happen to be playing and dominating. But we also have weight scales, so we can weight them based on their competition level. So yeah, you're averaging 30 in the YMCA league for the blind, but you know, but if you're playing in EYBL, you may be only averaging 15. And so now we have components to weigh that thing out as well. Right. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff that we pick with regards to draft numbers, the stuff we got on Luka Doncic and all the stuff we did that we submitted to the Mavs and just different things like that, you would be surprised. That matter of fact, you guys probably at some point should interview my Cerebro partners and let them show you what they're doing, because I'm telling you, some of the stuff that they've tapped into, even outside of that, I get updated on, but when I get updated, I'm blown away every time. They're like, man, that's top of the line wine right there. You know, I'm not in the internal meetings like I used to be, but when they give me the updates, I get blown away every time.
Yeah. That's awesome. So yeah. Cerebro had a little influence in the Mavs pulling the trigger on Luka?
No, I'm not going to say that. They have their own stuff. But I'm just saying, when you look at what we put together, you can show that we knew this is who he was going to be. Like, when you look at the, you know, the way that our data is laid out and everything, and we do it on a bronze, silver, and gold scale. When you see those pan out based on the numbers from when he was playing in Europe and all of that, we could have showed you that this kid right here is going to be that. We could have showed you John Morant. I mean, we showed you John Morant. The one that we had questioned, we had questioned because his numbers was off the chart, but we didn't have enough data on him, was Bol Bol. You know, his numbers were showing off the chart, but we didn't have enough information on him to be able to, you know, quantify that to say, yeah, we believe in that. You know, what we're showing for Bol Bol. But that, other than that, we hit everybody on the head.
Yeah, his Oregon numbers were ridiculous. It was like six games or something, but it was like 28 points and like ridiculous shooting for 7-2. Mm-hmm. Have you looked into overtime league at all? Or is there any sort of like stuff that they would do, you know, like trying to get the, you know, help them find the high schoolers that aren't even really, you know, juniors yet?
I know they've solidified some partnerships with you know the EYBL and Nike, mm-hmm. and uh-huh. I know they've been talking with the G League and you know we've had some meetings with Rod Strickland, who runs that, you know. Nice. you know bringing those high school players through that system. We also work with agencies, helping an agency to make a decision about whether or not they want to sign a player, so forth and so on. So we work with agencies in marketing organizations as well as who they want to market. So yeah, they do a lot. They do a lot than just basketball related stuff.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Where can people follow Cerebro and ePlay Analytics? They got a Twitter or Instagram?
CerebroSports.com. And you can get them at Cerebro Sports, I think, on their Instagram as well as maybe their Twitter.
Cool. And you do a, you alluded to, you do a little radio show?
Yeah, I have a radio show at 93.7, The Ticket FM. I work with a guy by the name of Derek Pearson. We do every Tuesday night from 6 to 8 Central. You can find us on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel, 93.7 The Ticket. We have a Twitter handle, same thing, 93.7 The Ticket, 93.7 The Ticket. They also have an Instagram as well, 93.7 The Ticket. My show, if you went to 93.7theticketfm.com, my show is the Strict 9 Show, and it's from 6 to 8 every Tuesday.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome. That's cool to see.
It's all in sports, but we have a focus on Husker. Our focus is on Husker, but we talk NFL, we talk MLB, we talk NBA, we talk, you know, what's in the news. So it's everything, but with a focus on Husker football, Husker basketball. I also do post-game shows, so I'll be on post-game for all Husker basketballs as well through 93.7 The Ticket as well.
Nice. What got you into the media side of the game?
Just got asked to come on, and nice. I guess they like me, I guess my personality and my take, you know, yeah, on things. And they wanted to offer me to do 5 days a week. I just said, I don't know if I'm ready for 5 days a week. Let's just do one and see how that goes. We'll go from there.
Definitely.
That's cool.
Kind of have anything, Eric, that you would want to, you know, leave for our viewers as a parting message? Any words of encouragement for anybody?
I would just say that whatever you see in your dream, whatever your dream is, position yourself to prosper. Don't always be the smartest person in the room. You know, you want to be able to acquire wisdom in the council of multitudes, right? You don't want to be the only one that everybody's looking to for information, advice, and for things of that nature. And I would also say, choice is important. You know, allow people the space to make decisions that's best for them, their families, and not be pressured into doing certain things in their lives. Whether it's a kid that you're pressuring because he's 6'8" to play back, he may be artistic, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Allow choice for them, because if you don't, you can end up, running people away or having people to have some animosity towards you and those specific assets. And try not to live vicariously through your kids. Love your kids, you know, inspire them, you know, help them to do well, but, you know, don't try not to live vicariously through that, because you may end up getting disappointed and it can cause friction between you and your family. So those are some things I think about.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for that. That's a lot too, you know, it's just being a young dad as well, but making sure, you know, allow your kids the choice and then, you know, to support that. So I think that's really great.
Yes. Some good drops of wisdom there. Where can people follow you specifically? It's Eastrick20, right?
Eastrick20 on Twitter, Eastrick2020 on Instagram, Eastrick20 Media on Instagram. So I try to defer my personal and the things that I do media-wise. I do through Eastrick Media, Eastrick20 Media. What else? I think that's all I have. Instagram. Yeah, Instagram. Those are my Instagram and Twitter. I'm not a big social media guy. I mean, I pop on there, pop off, hit it, quit it. You know, I'm on some, and then I'm off some. So, it's a little wild with regards to that. But those are places where I play.
Awesome. Nice. Hopefully, I know there's a lot of Eric Strickland fans out there already, but hopefully we got a few more people following the wisdom you have to drop for everybody, in the future here. And, we can all follow along on Cerebro and see what you got next coming down the pipe. So it's great great to see your success post-career, that's for sure.
Thank you, guys. Wonderful. You guys keep up the good work that you guys are doing as well. And then keep challenging yourselves to be a greater part of you, what you're doing.
Definitely will.
Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate that. Cool. Right. That was Eric. Thanks, man.